The story of a baseball game can be pretty straightforward. It's a story of balls and strikes, of pitching performances, of which team got the key hits, and of course, the most runs. But the story of baseball, well, that's quite another thing. For more than 150 years, people have been telling stories about what's been called our national pastime, what it represents, why we should cherish it, and what the game fosters in those who play it and those who watch it. Well, we could, as we usually do, leave it at that. Or we could see if another set of narratives can help shed light on baseball's origins and development. Enter Mitchell Nathanson, who, at the beginning of his book, A People's History of Baseball, acknowledges Howard Zinn's work as inspiration. Nathanson sees in baseball's history a set of struggles around class and race. One of its key ruptures, he argues, was influenced by the gains of the labor movement and by the protest movements of the 1960s. Mitchell Nathanson is professor of legal writing at Villanova Law School. When he joined me from Philadelphia, I asked him about the overarching project of his book.
The whole idea is to show that this whole essence of baseball as America is just a story, and there are other stories that you can tell when you put together the facts that deal with baseball as America and things like that. So what I was trying to do was take some of the well-known stories of baseball as America, not so much baseball, the game, how it's played on the field, but baseball and what it represents, and spin them a different way using the same facts, using the same sources to show that you can draw completely different conclusions regarding this idea of baseball as America.
And the title of your book, A People's History of Baseball, suggests that your focus, your inclination is to highlight stories of the people, stories of the players, stories of the actual participants in the game?
Well, it's looking at it from a different perspective. I think most of us are used to looking at the story of baseball from the owner's perspective, from the media's perspective, but we don't realize that's the perspective we're looking at it from. We just look at it as, well, this is the story of baseball. And I'm trying to say, well, that's a perspective, and here's a story from a different perspective, and you can see these different forces at play, the forces of ownership, the forces of the players, the forces of the fans. All of these different forces have their own perspective.
Let's go back to kind of the beginning of the story, the beginning of baseball in America in the mid-19th century. Now, of course, and you've written about this, the game of cricket was the game in Britain and in many of its possessions. How much of a head start did cricket, as compared with baseball, have in the U.S.?
Cricket had a huge head start. If you look at almost all of the former British possessions, cricket is the national and was the national game. And cricket was around for many years before baseball. And the thing that I found most interesting about it was, given that it had such a head start, why is it that today baseball is the national pastime and not cricket?
An excellent question, and we'll kind of get into the answer as we go along. But first, who were the early players of and promoters of cricket in the U.S.? What social classes were they drawn from?
Well, initially, the people who brought cricket over were obviously the British, but the game was co-opted by the WASP elites, northern elites, who tried to emulate that sort of social status that they believe went along with the game of cricket. Now, in reality, cricket in many countries is more of an egalitarian game. It's not a game for the upper classes, but in the United States, because class structure is a little more fluid, what happened was when the people who co-opted cricket tried to make it a marker of status rather than a marker of the nation as a whole.
Right. So you had all these upper-class WASP elites form these clubs, and I guess admission to these clubs and to, therefore, the game was limited, correct?
Correct. The whole point of these clubs, these cricket clubs, was not cricket. The whole point of these clubs was social status and a demonstration of social status. It didn't matter that they played cricket. What the whole point was to join these clubs, be members of these clubs, and by being a member of this particular club, you were demonstrating your higher social status. And so what happened was the people who formed these clubs and populated these clubs used them to keep everybody else out. And by keeping everybody else out, they were able to say to themselves and to everybody else that they were the upper class, they were the elites, and since they were the upper class, this was their game. It was not a game for the lower classes.
And what about baseball at first in the U.S.? What kind of people played baseball?
Well, there were all sorts of people who played baseball. And when we say baseball, we tend to think of one game, but there were all sorts of games in the 19th century that people called baseball one word or two words. As long as there have been bats and balls, there have been people playing a game where you'd throw the ball and somebody tries to hit it. There was a game up in New England, which was a rougher game, which was a boys' game. There were all sorts of games. But in New York, where the game really coalesced, the game of baseball that we know today really comes from New York, not so much the Massachusetts game. But it was a lot different. It was a game that was created by merchants, artisans, people who had some money but not the status of these people who were in the upper class clubs. And they co-opted baseball much the same way their social betters co-opted cricket, and they tried to make baseball an emblem of their social status.
And what would a successful project of that kind do to the people who took up and played baseball in its early years? What would promoting baseball as opposed to cricket, in competition with cricket, do to their standing in society or their understanding of where their standing in society would go?
Well, the people who formed the baseball clubs, and I'm overgeneralizing, there were upper-class clubs where they played both baseball and cricket, and there were lower-class clubs, working-class clubs, where they played cricket and baseball or just cricket. But for the most part, the upper-class clubs were generally cricket clubs. These middle-class clubs were baseball clubs, and what the middle-class rising middle class wanted is they wanted acceptance into that upper class, into that WASP elites. The WASP elites were keeping them out, generally through arguments of ethnicity and family lineage, basically saying, well, you're not true Americans. If you didn't come over on the Mayflower, you're not part of this upper class elite. What these people did is they tried to use baseball to demonstrate that they're American-ness, to coin a word, I guess. And so they try to become the proponents of this American game and to show off to everybody else the idea that, hey, we're Americans, we're promoting a truly American game, and therefore not only do we have money, but we have status as well. And they try to use the game of baseball to jump into that upper class.
Mitch Nathanson joins us on Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. He is a professor of legal writing at the Villanova University School of Law, and he's author of A People's History of Baseball, published by the University of Illinois Press. So you write that baseball in the U.S. at first was a player's game. So I take it you mean these sort of middle class and artisan class clubs. And it remained that way. The players were at center stage, the backers or the owners stayed in the background until 1876. What happened then?
Well, these clubs were really clubs. They weren't clubs like we think of a baseball club today, which is really a professional franchise. They were clubs. There was club membership, and you joined a club and you played baseball, and that was the whole idea, was to be a member of the club. What happened was, in the race for stature, the idea became not only to prove that these clubs were as prestigious as cricket clubs, but that my baseball club is better than your baseball club. And so what happened was these various clubs, which promoted themselves as gentlemanly and upstanding, were hiring ringers and paying them under the table, people who could help them win a game. And generally what happened is, as the game became more professionalized, it was officially made a professional game in 1871. What happened is, as the players, the game became more professionalized, the players took over. Well, the backers, the people who had started these clubs initially and who really weren't athletes, they were more, as I said, they were merchants, artisans, things like that. Well, they were in the background and they were fading away, which seemed to contradict the whole reason why they started the club in the first place. So with the game controlled by the players, the ones with the best athletic ability, these people who were backing them and paying their expenses were really fading out. And when the game in the 1870s began to have some problems with gambling, players leaving for one club to go to another club where they'd be paid more, these backers saw an opportunity to reassert themselves, put themselves back in the foreground, which is what they did in the creation of the National League in 1876, where they took control of the game away. They took it away from the players, made it more of an owner's game, and put themselves out front instead of being in the background where they had fallen back to over the previous few years.
And then what stories of rescue and heroism did the new club owners of the National League tell and propagate?
Well, just like before, when the National League was formed, even though it was a professional league and there were professional players and they were being paid, the whole idea of the National League was that the people who were interested in professional baseball, the clubs in the National League who would come out to see the games, were people of the highest social standing, people like themselves or how they perceive themselves. So what they did was they tried to present a game to the public of basically an elitist sort of a game, just like the cricket clubs were. Basically, what they were trying to say to the public was, here is a game where the best classes, the highest classes of the nation congregate to enjoy sport. And so what they did is they tried to keep the lower classes out. They banned games on Sundays, which was the only day the working class, most working class people had off where they could actually go to a baseball game. They banned liquor, which of course many of the German, Irish immigrants enjoyed a beer on a Sunday or during a game, couldn't have it during a baseball game, so they wouldn't be interested. Kept ticket prices artificially high. And so what they tried to do was limit participation and spectatorship to people of, I guess, their own kind or who they perceive to be their own kind.
Eventually, you write, the National League owners no longer promoted baseball as a game merely for gentlemen. Rather, they promoted it as a game that could allow anyone at all, to become a gentleman, to become a model American citizen. What prompted this change of emphasis?
Well, try as they might to limit the game to their own social classes, baseball was popular with other classes as well, and rival leagues formed. One of them was the American Association, another was the Union Association. There were other rival leagues. And these were leagues that appealed to working class people. And they outdrew the National League, which was stodgy even from the beginning, right away. So this is through the 1880s. The National League had a lot of competition. They were forced to merge with the working class American Association and take in some of their teams and, along with the teams, appeal to those fans. So they could no longer promote the game as really, this is a game for gentlemen, but it's a game that anyone could watch and learn traditional American values, become an American. And just by watching the game and playing the game, you would learn what it meant to be an American. So they were appealing to these working classes, lower classes, immigrant classes, to look at baseball as a way to acculturate, which was different from what they did initially, where they didn't care at all about those people. Now they had, because those people were coming to their games through the merger, they had to appeal to them in some way, and they, in order to keep the tie between baseball and America together, this is what they did.
You quote a journalist writing in 1907 that, so long as it remains our national game, namely baseball, America will abide no monarchy, and anarchy will be slow. So it extended to sort of America, baseball, and democracy, right?
Right. The whole idea was, looking at it today, I mean, it's a pretty laughable idea, but this was the idea, and there was a lot of this sort of journalism at that time, that just by watching baseball, you could learn how to become an American. You could learn what democracy was. There's a lot of articles at the time, this is the turn of the century, that were talking about on the baseball field, there's true democracy. It's the only thing that matters is who's the best that day. Nothing else matters. Family background, lineage, all those other things are washed away, and all that matters is who's the best that day. And this was the argument that was made over and over and over in the sports section, where when you opened your newspaper and read about the game the previous day, not only did you get who won, but you got all this other stuff as well. And so you really got a lesson in at least what these people and these journalists were trying to promote in terms of civics as well as baseball.
This baseball creed, the notion that baseball teaches and promotes American values and ideals, how did it square with the social science of the day?
Initially, the people who promoted it, the merchant class and the artisan class, they were trying to get into the whole point for them was social status. It was never about making money. These people had money. They were looking for status. And they used this baseball creed to try to show the WASP elites that they were as American as everybody else. When they were forced to take in the lower classes and the working classes and the immigrant classes, they had to change the creed a little bit and make the creed something which would appeal to those people and would appeal to those fans and give them something to work towards, to look towards, basically saying, if you watch baseball, you can learn what it is to be an American, which really struck at the heart of social Darwinism, which was the social science theory that the WASP elites were really pushing at the time. The idea of heritage and family lineage being important, environment being irrelevant. The idea being that either you were born into privilege, you were born into a certain stature of life, or you were not worthy of it. Obviously, if you were an immigrant coming over and you didn't have this family lineage, you didn't come over on the Mayflower, the idea of social Darwinism isn't going to work for you. But the idea of a more malleable social theory that you can acquire these skills is certainly something that would appeal to you much more than social Darwinism, which basically dooms you from the start. So this is what baseball promoted, and given its increasing fan base, which was, again, became more and more working class, immigrant-type people, it resonated. And it was consistent with the social science of the day, which was more of an evolutionary environmentalism practiced by John Dewey, which really focused more on environment rather than heredity as being the important factor in acculturation and rising up societally. So if you're an immigrant and you come to this country with nothing, and there's a social theory out there that says you can come from nothing and you can make yourself into whatever you want, that's certainly going to appeal to you. That was environmentalism, and that was also the baseball creed.
What impact did this creed of, hey, you know, you take up baseball or you watch baseball, you can assimilate into mainstream U.S. culture more readily? What impact did that have on people who might have no desire to assimilate into mainstream culture?
Well, it was forced on a lot of people. It's interesting, you know, we look back on it with rose-colored glasses that, oh, you know, what harm could it have? But there were certainly groups in this country who didn't want to assimilate. There were Native American groups who were forced to assimilate. The Carlisle Indian School really forced baseball on its students with the idea being that if they played baseball, they would become true Americans. You know, ironic that they were the truest Americans. But from the perspective of the people who were trying to get these Native Americans to adopt the presiding social values of the day, this was a way to do it. And it didn't go over very well with many Native Americans. Their culture was ripped away from them, replaced with this other idea that this is good for them and would replace everything that they had grown up with.
We've put a link on againstthegrain.org to my guest Mitchell Nathanson's book, A People's History of Baseball, recently out from the University of Illinois Press, as well as to his book, The Fall of the 1977 Phillies, How a Baseball Team's Collapse Sank a City's Spirit. Mitch's work focuses on the intersection of sports, law, and society. He teaches legal writing at the Villanova University School of Law. All right, I want to kind of move things forward historically. Your basic message during kind of one of the key chapters in this book is that there were 16 owners of Major League Baseball clubs for decades. They maintained hegemony over the game and over the players well into the 20th century. How strong was the owner's position from the late 19th century to the mid-20th century, and how subservient were the players?
The owners always made the case, and it was always perceived that the owners were really strong. Again, this goes back to the 19th century when they co-opted the game from the players. The whole idea behind the National League was that this was going to be an owners' league and not a players' league. And the owners worked in concert and presented the game as something which the players were just happy to be there. The owners, they were the protectors of this baseball creed. They were the ones who were protecting the game, the values of the games. The players really, in many ways, were considered interlopers. They played the game, I guess because somebody had to play it. But beyond that, they really didn't, they certainly weren't considered partners. And they were really considered to be nothing more than just the necessary tools that were needed to have this game of baseball say what it needed to say. I mean, people enjoyed the games, but the idea of baseball as America was something that the owners preached as coming from them, and the players had really very little to do with it.
What about the issue of money? During this period, was owning a Major League Baseball team about making money, about doing well financially?
There wasn't a lot of money in Major League Baseball. That's not to say that owners lost money. Most teams, even if they didn't do well, generally turned a profit through the first half of the 20th century. The Philadelphia Phillies were a horrible team for decades. They finished in last place, next to last place, virtually every year in the 30s and the early 40s. And yet, almost every year, they turned at least a moderate profit. The Chicago Cubs, another team that did well early in the 20th century and didn't do well, haven't done well since, they too, they broke even. They'd make a little bit of money, but nobody was making a lot of money because the whole idea was not to make money. If the idea was to make money, these teams would be competitive with each other much more than they were. But what you saw in the pre-free agency era was one team, the Yankees, dominating everybody else, and all of the other teams, their putative competitors, were selling their best players to the Yankees, not so much because they wanted the Yankees to win, but because they wanted to balance their ledgers at the end of each season, and that's really all they, ultimately, that's really all they cared about.
And then you've got a really interesting analysis in this book of why things went so terribly wrong for the owners in the 60s and the 70s. Your contention is that the owners were fatally weakened well before Marvin Miller and the Players Association went on the offensive. And I want to begin with a factor you called the corporate revolution. Tell us about that.
Right. The corporate revolution occurred post-World War II and basically made everything in America bigger. Before World War II, when we talked about corporate America, you were talking really about mom-and-pop organizations. I mean, some of those organizations, companies, made a lot of money. There were a few giant ones, and there were some giant trusts, and certainly those existed. But for the most part, most companies were very simply constructed in a single line of business or two lines of business. They operated in maybe one state or a few states. They were really top-down, simple organizations. Post-World War II, everything got bigger, everything got more complex, there were a lot of mergers and acquisitions, and what you started to see post-World War II was a lot of companies involved in a lot of different types of businesses, a lot of different industries, national, international, and everything just became more complex. And that affected everything, and it affected baseball as well.
And so as baseball club ownership began to turn over and new owners began to emerge and to take over operations, what kinds of people were they? How were they different than the people who belonged to kind of the closed club of 16 MLB owners until the 1950s?
Well, when you had the 16 owners, you had two generally, and again, I'm generalizing because there's all different types, and ownership changed throughout the time period, of course, but generally there were two types of owners. There were the aristocrats, and then there were the people like Tom Yawkey, who owned the Red Sox, later Bob Carpenter, who was a DuPont, who owned the Phillies, and they had just inherited a ton of money and basically could do what they wanted. And then you had the businessmen. I talk about Del Webb, who was one of the owners of the Yankees. And he was a businessman through and through. He was involved in a lot of different things. He was in construction. Powell Crosley was involved in a bunch of different things. He owned the Reds. But they had owned simple, their companies were very simply constructed. And at the end of the day, Powell Crosley and Del Webb spoke for the company. So they could sit down with the other owners and they could make a decision right there. And later, what happened as a result of the corporate revolution, what you started to see was owners from these large multinational corporations coming in, people who had made their money from these huge corporations, and they no longer had the ability to just make a decision right there at the table. They had boards of directors. They had all sorts of other things to worry about. They had competition from other sports within their city. And what happened is you have so many people at the table with so many different interests. And they were, as a whole, these people in the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and up through today, they're much more powerful in terms, if we're just talking about money and influence. They're much more powerful today than the owners were back then. But the owners back then were able to be cohesive because they could make decisions and they weren't really looking to make a ton of money. They were just looking to survive from year to year. And when you're looking to survive from year to year, it's easier to act as a group to ensure that everybody stays around. Nowadays, that's a lot different.
Yeah, I guess beginning around the time we're talking about, the 60s, 70s, huge conglomerates like Disney, Time Warner, and the Tribune Company began to own controlling interests in ball clubs. My guest is Mitch Nathanson. He's a professor of legal writing at the Villanova University School of Law. We were talking about his new book, A People's History of Baseball. We'll continue with our discussion after this short music break. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, online at kpfa.org. My name is C.S. Song. Mitch Nathanson teaches at the Villanova University School of Law. We are talking about his book, A People's History of Baseball. We've got a link to that book and to other work by Mitch on our website, againstthegrain.org. All right, so the maybe you would call it the mainstream story of the owner's demise in the second half of the 20th century proclaims, asserts that it was Marvin Miller and the Players Association that is responsible for the downfall of the owners. Beginning in 1966, Marvin Miller led the Players Association. He became its executive director that year. Now, you've already pointed to the corporate revolution as kind of weakening the owners. So is it your contention then that the corporate revolution and other factors set the conditions for the success of Miller and the PA?
Yes. Marvin Miller obviously is important, and the Players Association were huge. But when they, by the time they became powerful, they were dealing with an ownership group that was frayed at the seams. This was not the same ownership group that existed in the 30s. One of the interesting things that I learned in doing the research for this was if you go back through all of baseball's labor history in the 70s and the 80s with Bowie Kuhn and Marvin Miller constantly at odds, one thing that Bowie Kuhn always said was that, you know, the players come and go, but the owners are here forever, and the owners are the protectors of the game because the owners are always around and the players are the ones. They come, they go. They don't really have the bigger picture in mind. But what I found was, starting in the 60s, it was the owners who were coming and going at an incredibly rapid rate. There were always owners who, there's always a turnover in ownership. But once you got to the 60s, first of all, you had expansion, real expansion from 16 to 20, then to 24, then 26, and then 30 teams. You have a lot of different owners, and they're not staying in the game as long as they were before. And when you have owners, every time you have an owners meeting and there are different people sitting there than were sitting there last year, it's hard to be cohesive. And when it's hard to be cohesive, basically what you end up with is a lot of people arguing about what they want today. Forget yesterday, because most of them weren't there for yesterday. Forget tomorrow, because they might not be there tomorrow. And you had owners fighting with other owners. And when you have that dynamic going on, if you have a focused players association, you're going to run right over the owners. And that's what happened.
Right. So the players association became focused, became empowered. How? What, for example, social and political forces, broader forces in society, affected the players and their ability and motivation to confront the owners?
It had been beaten into the players for so long that they had no rights in the game. They were lucky to be there. Every year of contract time, no matter how good a particular player was, he was told that there's 4 more or 5 more or 15 more guys in the minors who were just waiting to take his spot. And this isn't just a journeyman ball player. Mickey Mantle had this as well. Everybody was told this story. Eventually, though, they start to see the value in unionization. And it's not just that the players all of a sudden figured out, hey, we should unionize. Unionization was really on the upswing in the mid part of the 20th century. And so the Players Association latched onto that. For many years, the Players Association wasn't really strong, but the Players Association was able to get some information to the players. And slowly, and this is in the 1950s and the early 60s, before Marvin Miller was there, they started to see, as workers were seeing in all sorts of industries, the value in combining and working together toward a single goal. So they really initially took their cues from the labor movement, but the problem was is that they never saw themselves as labor per se. It had been beaten into them so long that they were not labor, that they were, how could you call this labor? It's you're playing a game for a living. You know, you're not the same as a steel worker, for example. And so you really weren't going to get that far just drawing a clear line between the players and the steel workers. But it was also the student free speech movement in the 60s, which also really influenced the players, because the students were not labor. They were considered privileged people as well, and they were rising up. They were part of an institution that didn't seem to care about them, didn't seem to care about what their rights were, what they thought, treated them with a sort of benevolent paternalism that really didn't give them any sort of rights that general people had. So the players saw this, and they realized, you know, it's not just labor that can join together. It's people who are otherwise relatively privileged, like us. And they drew from a lot of different things, but they really drew from that, along with the labor movement. And I think that gave them a lot of a feeling that what they were doing was not selfish, but was something that was, first of all, in keeping with what was going on everywhere else in the country at the time, and was something which was, there was a bigger picture to it. It wasn't just about getting more money. It was about standing up for yourself and standing up for your rights.
This is quite a departure from one mainstream story, which is that the players were sort of brainwashed by Marvin Miller.
Yeah, they certainly weren't brainwashed. One thing that Marvin Miller did when he first started going around to the camps was he listened to the players. It wasn't like he came in and said, okay, here's what we're doing. He went to the camps, he listened to what the players' gripes were, and he found that, first of all, a lot of them had problems with their pension plan. And so he focused on that. And because he focused on that really because that's what the majority of the players thought was important. And that's true for the average player as well as a superstar player. He also learned from the players that, unlike a traditional labor union, they didn't want Marvin Miller to negotiate their contracts for them. If you think about it, a traditional labor union, the union negotiates the contract for everybody. The players didn't want that. And so Marvin Miller listened to them, and he basically let the players take the lead. He certainly guided them, but they weren't being blindly driven by Marvin Miller at all. And a matter of fact, he encouraged the players to attend all the labor negotiation sessions, because basically what he was saying was, if you don't believe what I'm saying to you about the owners, go to these negotiating sessions and listen to what they're saying about you themselves, yourselves. And so they did, and many of the players were stunned when they came out of those negotiations by just what their owners thought about them, and it empowered them even more.
So you've got this group of empowered, more and more informed players, and then you have Curt Flood, an African-American baseball player who in the late 1960s was playing center field for the St. Louis Cardinals. What did Flood instigate in the late 60s, and what impact did that have on the way players and the Players Association thought and conducted themselves?
Flood was really interesting because he, more so than anybody else, delineated the difference between rights and privileges. And as I said, for years, the story the players were sold was the owners have the right to be in the game because of their social status, which is, again, what they've been working towards since the 19th century. The players were privileged to be there. They could come and go as the owners saw fit. Curt Flood, when he refused to be traded from the Cardinals to the Phillies at the end of the 1969 season, he wrote a letter to Commissioner Bowie Kuhn, Christmas Eve, 1969, talking about rights and privileges and saying that he had a right as a human being to decide where he wanted to go. And it wasn't about privilege. It was about rights. And he had a basic human right. And it didn't matter how much he was being paid. After a certain number of years in the game, he had the right to dictate where he could ply his trade. And this was a shock to a lot of the owners who never thought about things like that. And for many years, refused to think about things that way. But what he did is he really legitimized the player's position. And you know, as an African-American, and really the players who were on the forefront of all this, of the legitimization of the Players Association, were almost all African-American players. Curt Flood is the most obvious, but Dick Allen, although he was not an overt champion of the Players Association, he also would stand up for himself and say, you know what, I have certain rights. I have the right to do this and that and to do that. You can't tell me what to do left and right like you think you could. Vida Blue, Reggie Jackson from the A's, also in the late 60s, early 70s, stood up for themselves, held out. And what they did is they showed the other players, and I think they showed a lot of the white players who couldn't otherwise see it, that baseball wasn't just about privilege. It was a work environment, and as a work environment, you should be guaranteed certain basic rights. And coming out of the civil rights movement, the African-American players, I think, were able to see things more clearly than the white players, and they were able to convince their brethren that this is not just about money, it's about basic human rights. And once they were able to convince the majority that this was a bigger issue than just how much do we get paid in the next labor agreement or my next contract, the players really became unified, and given what the owner situation was like, that was really it for the owners.
My guest Mitch Nathanson's most recent book is A People's History of Baseball. He's also written numerous articles on the interplay between baseball and U.S. culture, and he teaches legal writing. He's a professor at the Villanova University School of Law. Okay, and we really can't tell this narrative, relate this story without talking about the mid-1970s. So what happened in 1975 to Andy Messersmith, a Dodgers pitcher, and Dave McNally, an Expos pitcher, and what happened in 1976 around the formation of a certain collective bargaining agreement?
Well, Curt Flood, most people think Curt Flood, when he refused to report to the Phillies and he took his case, he filed an antitrust lawsuit against Major League Baseball over the reserve clause, which prevented him from going where he wanted to go. It was his contention that the reserve clause violated his basic human rights and more technically violated the Sherman Act. Most people assume that he won his case, but he lost at the Supreme Court, and his career was essentially over. But he empowered the players. What happened in the interim as this case was going forward is that the players were able to get an arbitration clause in their 1970 collective bargaining agreement, and they were eventually able to arbitrate the one-year renewal clause, the reserve clause, in all of their contracts. Everybody's contract had this one-year renewal clause, which said basically you can sign a contract, the player, but if you don't sign, you're automatically renewed for the next year. And the owners interpreted that as being that it renews perpetually, which means a player can never be a free agent. Messersmith and McNally challenged that in 1975 because there was an independent arbitrator, which the players won the right to that in 1970. The independent arbitrator agreed with them and basically did away with this reserve clause and basically said, well, you've got a contract and you've got that one option year, but after that one option year, if you don't sign a contract, you're a free agent. And he essentially set the players free, although the owners refused to acknowledge that. And there was a lockout in 1976, the 1976 spring training. And eventually, a collective bargaining agreement in 1976 officially acknowledged free agency in baseball.
And, you know, we can talk about all these developments. We can say, okay, well, the Players Association got the upper hand. We can say baseball changed a lot. But could you go over, as you do in your book, can you tell us how dramatically the game of baseball in 1980 differed from the game of the 1950s?
The interesting thing about baseball in 1980 was that it was so completely a player's game as opposed to an owner's game. If you think back upon the great, you can think of the stars of the 40s and the 50s and even into the 60s. But you also probably, if you're a pretty good baseball fan, you probably know the names of a lot of the owners of the clubs. You know Tom Yawkey and Bob Carpenter and Walter O'Malley and Powell Crosley and all these people who own these clubs. And probably if you were a pretty good baseball fan in Chicago, you knew that the Wrigleys owned the Cubs and things like that. 1980, you might know the players. You would probably not know the owners. The owners had pretty much reverted to the background, once again, just as they were in the 1870s. Again, it was a player's game. The owners were still fighting, but they really had retreated into anonymity by that point. It was incredibly quick because in 1960, the owners seemed to have such a chokehold on the game. And within 20 years, most fans couldn't even name the owner of their club. And you know what? If they knew the owner of their club this year, 3 years from now, it would be somebody else.
And there was, by that time, plenty of expansion too, right? Something the closed club of owners had really fought against.
Right. There were now 30 clubs. Well, there would eventually be 30 clubs. There was 26, I think, in 1980. And the owners always wanted to keep the closed club at 16. If they were as powerful as they said they were, and with an antitrust exemption, they should have been able to keep it. But they weren't. They weren't all that powerful. There were bigger forces at play. There were new people who came in who were determined to do what they wanted and to break it up. And most of these people were other owners, which was the interesting thing.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Mitchell Nathanson is my guest. We are talking about his book, A People's History of Baseball. And I should say, we're really scratching the surface. There's so many very interesting insights in Mitch's book, and we have a link to that on againstthegrain.org. Now, your book is also about how the people, not the players or the owners, but the people, the fans, attempted with varying degrees of success to take control away or to appropriate some control over the game to themselves, away from the MLB establishment. One guy who figures prominently in this regard is Bill James. He was born in 1949. He was a Kansas City Athletics fan in his youth, and he was the author, most famously, he is the author of the Baseball Abstracts, which for many years were published annually, beginning in the 70s and then into the 80s. What did Bill James, as someone outside the baseball establishment until relatively recently, what did he do to challenge the baseball creed and to formulate kind of an alternative way, a new way of understanding the game?
Bill James was the ultimate outsider. He didn't even have a club, as you said. He was a Kansas City A's fan. The A's moved away. He had no club. So he just became a fan of baseball. And he was really interested. He was interested in social science. He was interested in all sorts of academic disciplines, but he was really interested in baseball. And he was certainly interested in statistics and looking at different ways of seeing the game. And he figured out that you could really understand the game much differently than it had been presented by the so-called insiders, the people who controlled, who ran Major League Baseball, or the sports writers who were writing about the game. For years, it had always been sold that, well, in order to understand baseball, you had to be, you had to listen to a general manager. You had to listen to the sports writer who was covering the team. You had to talk to the people who were right at the stadium every day. But he figured out that there were other ways of looking at the game that were different. And he looked at a lot of the statistics that had been really accepted as sacrosanct for many years, the RBI and things like that. And he realized that they only tell part of the story. And you could look at the game differently. You could look at different statistics. You didn't need these other people to tell you what was happening on the field. You could watch the game and you could understand the game yourself just if you paid attention. And particularly if you had a computer and had access to all different sorts of statistics, you could really see a game more deeply. And what he did was he challenged a lot of the assumptions that were foisted upon people for decades, such as certain players were better than other players. Well, those assumptions were based on the maybe raw statistics, but didn't take into account whether somebody played in a live ball era or a dead ball era, or they played in one ballpark versus another ballpark, or who was batting before them or after them in the lineup. And when he looked at those things, he saw a completely different game. And what he did was he compiled his own set of statistics, because Major League Baseball was not free in giving those statistics out. The Elias Sports Bureau controlled those statistics. And if you tried to get them, they charged a prohibitive amount of money for those statistics. So he just looked at these games and kept his own statistics. And that's where these baseball abstracts came from. And in these baseball abstracts, he was able to determine that a player that perhaps was being touted as a great player wasn't so good. He was more of a the product of playing in a certain stadium. And maybe there are these other players whose batting averages were lower, but they were better because they were responsible for driving in more runs. And what he really did was he challenged the way we looked at the game, and he challenged the way we understood the game. And basically, all these years of looking at baseball as a metaphor for American values and things like that, he deconstructed all of that. And he looked at baseball just as baseball and said, you know, all those other things don't really matter. What matters are the statistics on the field, these circumstances on the field. And by deconstructing baseball, you could see the game as it was really being played, as opposed to the game that was being spoon-fed by Major League Baseball and the people who had Major League Baseball's interest in mind.
Would Moneyball, as developed and practiced by the Oakland Athletics, would that have happened but for Bill James?
It's interesting that Moneyball, that approach was ever even adopted, because Bill James had been touting that sort of approach for years, and baseball teams ignored him. He thought initially, when he put together his baseball abstracts, that Major League Baseball teams would be calling him, asking for his advice on trades and things like that, but they shunned him, and they basically thought he was an interloper and didn't really want to have much to do with him. But eventually, he was able to get his ideas across. And yeah, in Oakland, you really see, it's not just Bill James. There are a lot of people involved in that sort of analysis. But yeah, you certainly would not have seen this before Bill James.
And then there's fantasy baseball. For those who aren't familiar with it, can you just lay out the basics of fantasy baseball? And also tell us why it represents another challenge to the way people have traditionally understood baseball.
Well, fantasy baseball is a game where you draft players from different teams, and then they become players on your team. And so you could have one player from the A's, and one from the Giants, and one from the Dodgers, and one from the Angels. And you construct your own team. You follow them, your mythical team, as it goes through the season, and you compete with friends or coworkers or whatever. And it was a huge change in the way people looked at baseball, because baseball had always been looked at as a team game. And if you go back to the earliest writings about baseball as America, what you see is this spirit of baseball as teamwork and things like that. the run batted in was considered such an important statistic 100 and some odd years ago because it was seen as the ultimate sacrifice, where you did something to let somebody else score a run. And baseball had always been developed around this love of the team. Like, your team was the A's or the Giants or whoever it was. Fantasy baseball takes that team element right out of the game, and it returns the game to its essence, which is basically balls and strikes and hits and outs and home runs and doubles and strikeouts and all the other advanced statistics. All these ways of looking at baseball as a game rather than as a metaphor for something else. When people play fantasy baseball, they're just looking at how many home runs their team got last night, or runs batted in, or things like that. They're not looking at this baseball as America and baseball telling us something else about American society. They're just looking at the game. And that's all what Bill James was talking about for years, that baseball is baseball. It's a sport. It's a game. That's really all it is. It doesn't stand in for anything else, contrary to what people had been saying for well over a century. It was really, at its heart, just a game. And it can be appreciated and loved as a game, but you get into trouble when you start looking at it as standing in for something else, something more important than that. And as an owner, as a team owner, I don't think you would like that, because part of the reason you're involved in Major League Baseball is for the societal standing, the status thing you get out of it. And when fantasy baseball players take that out of the equation, it diminishes who you are. And really, it goes along with everything else that's been diminished as a Major League Baseball club owner nowadays. I mean, they're really in the background. They don't really stand in for any sort of greater social value or societal status or anything like that. They basically own the club in your town until somebody else owns it. And believe me, that's not the way they envisioned it back in 1876.
Mitchell Nathanson is professor of legal writing at the Villanova University School of Law. We've been talking about his book, A People's History of Baseball, published by the University of Illinois Press. Mitch, thanks so much for joining me.
Well, thanks for having me. It's been a lot of fun.
And this is Sia suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we will look for you next time. Against the Grain is produced by C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. You can also give us a call at 510-848-6767, extension 670, and check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio. That's Against the Grain Radio on Facebook. Many thanks to Carla West, who's at the controls today.